Welcome to the Panza Panza Forum. In the Yoruba language, the word panza is usually injected into poetry to express an uncomfortable, uncensored, and inconvenient truth. The Panza Panza Forum is candid conversations about the life of African immigrants in America as it relates to their adaptation to their new home. While some may find it easy to integrate and can balance between retaining the original African culture while accepting the culture of their new home, many continue to struggle to find a balance between both worlds.
Hello and welcome to Panza Panza Live. This is a podcast where we discuss the lives of African immigrants and their assimilation into Western society as they raise younger generations in a country that is quite different from their own. We also explore the experiences of children of immigrants as they balance the African and Western cultures. We present to you this informative, interesting, and expansive dialogue about the intricate experiences of African immigrants in America.
Okay, welcome to Panza Panza. I'm your host, Kemi Seriki, and today I am so honored to have Dr. Adegboyega Ogunwale and Dr. Oladayo Bifarin. I recently came across their research publication on PubMed titled Indigenous Mental Health Care and Human Rights Abuse in Nigeria, the role of cultural beliefs and stigmatization and how it affects providing seeking appropriate mental health services in Nigeria. And as I said in my email, I agree totally with your insight and the impact the cultural beliefs and the stigma surrounding mental health hinders advancement in implementing adequate care in Nigeria. So as a Nigerian immigrant living in the United States, I've witnessed how this belief often persists among African immigrants, affecting our community's willingness to seek appropriate mental health services when the need arises. And as many know, when proper care is not in place for someone suffering from mental health challenges, it could lead to unnecessary poor quality of life, not limited to disability, but unemployment, substance abuse, homelessness, imprisonment, and even suicide. So to give a brief bio about Dr. Ogunwale, he is a chief consultant psychiatrist in Neuropsychiatric Hospital in Aru, Abeokuta in Nigeria, and is the chair of Emerging Forensic System Interest Group, International Association of Forensic Mental Health Services. And Dr. Oludayo Bifarin is a registered mental health nurse and quality improvement partner at NHS Liverpool in England. He's a senior lecturer in mental health nursing, passionate about nursing education and promoting recovery. So welcome to both of you, to Panza Panza. I really appreciate both of you for setting time aside from your busy schedule, as we said. I really appreciate this. And my guests are located both in England. So I'm so delighted to have both of you on this platform to share your wisdom about the importance of this topic with members of African immigrant community in the diaspora. So as I always ask my guests, I'm curious to know about your background. I would appreciate if both of you could talk a little bit about your background as to where you were born, where you spent most of your childhood and adult life. So I'll go first to Dr. Ogunwale to introduce himself.
Thank you very much, Ms. Seriki, for inviting me and inviting Dr. Bifarin as well. Well, I was born in Nigeria, raised in Nigeria, had my primary, secondary, university education in Nigeria, and started practicing medicine in Nigeria. A few years down the line, I developed an interest in psychiatry. And after some years of training at the prestigious Neuropsychiatric Hospital, Aru Abeokuta, which we call the heartland of psychiatry in Nigeria, I completed my training and then I became a general adult psychiatrist. All through my training, it was quite something interesting to me to look at the interface between law and psychiatry. So that led me to specialize. Well, in Nigeria, we don't have all these specialties per se, but we become specialists by experience and developing competence over time. So I chose that subspecialty, forensic psychiatry. Forensic psychiatry is three things. Basically, the assessment and treatment of mentally abnormal offenders, civil law aspects related to psychiatry, as well as ethics. So I developed along these three lines, and that's been my practice for some years now. Currently, I'm undertaking my PhD studies in forensic psychiatry research at King's College London, Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience. So it's been, for me, a journey into looking after those who are mentally ill and then moving on to looking after mentally ill offenders. My interest in research had been largely fueled by the fact that I saw that clinical practice without research evidence to back up contemporariness would eventually become stale and uninteresting, and in fact could become unsafe, because you would be rendering very archaic care within the current situation in which you find yourself. So I began to develop interest in research as well, and that has informed the different streams of research that I've gone into, including the one that you read about, which is basically looking at the role of indigenous mental health treatment and how culture feeds into all of that, and also how that interfaces with forensic psychiatry in terms of, okay, looking at the human rights of those who are being treated and whether they are being treated with dignity and fairly. So that's like a background from my end. Okay. Yes.
So I want to go to, thank you so much for that, Dr. Bifarin.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Sariki. It's a pleasure to be here today. For me, I was born and bred in Nigeria. I moved to the UK in very early 20s. And my first degree was in pure science, so for industrial chemistry. And I came to the UK, and it was a case of this experience that I had was very much along the lines of people struggling to get access to for mental health support. That something has to get a breaking point before interventions are actually then coming through. And at that point, oftentimes it's too late. So that was what motivated me to sort of, you know, actually this idea of nursing the mind. What does that mean? What might that look like? So my career in mental health is very much rooted in desire to address the global disparities in healthcare access and outcomes. Growing up in Nigeria, I was exposed to people, you know, people, and I say that in every sense. And again, coming to the UK, it was, you know, getting that exposure to people not actually getting the basic human rights in terms of people's mental health. And for me, it is that particular barrier often stemmed from cultural and systemic barriers. And I've always had interest in how cultural and systemic barriers, how they intersect in that sense. And my academic and professional journey has focused on bridging these gaps and sort of exploring cultural practices. And when I say cultural practices, it's not just about ethnicity. It's really important to also, sort of think of our systems and processes, how they allow people to use services or not allow them to use services. And for me, it's a case of going to Dr. Gunwale's areas where what actually led me to research is, it's important for us not to forget that if we're talking about mental health care delivery, it's really important that the service we provide, they must be personal. It's important that the service provide as well, they are proven. And it's really, it's crucial that it's precise. So it's got to be proven, it's got to be personal, it's got to be precise. And that's where research comes to light in terms of, unless we understand the context and nature of the problem, we can't solve this this issue. And that's what's driven me to my role as a research and effectiveness lead for my trust at the moment. And I'm also a senior lecturer in mental health nursing at my university, Local Jomos University. Yeah, a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much. So what would you say sparked your initial interest into going into psychiatric care?
If you are, quickly jump on that one, and I'll pass over to Dr. Ogunwale.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Olade.
For me, it's that knowledge gap. There's a massive knowledge gap. There's an assumption that we know. And the question is, do we really know?
Yeah.
There's a lot to talk about in terms of different knowledge. And they all have a role to play. So because you've gone to do psychiatry at the university, because you've gone to do mental health nursing, you have an aspect of knowledge. Your patients, people that you're treating and supporting as well, they are also, they've got knowledge themselves.
Yes.
Now, the knowledge is great. And of course, people's realities might also not be the same. So how do you ensure that we are mindful of this different knowledge as well as different realities? Because the argument I always make is, the more we can actually marry up different realities, the better the interventions we're likely to be able to develop, which would work for most people. So it's really important that we don't exclude and use, you know, our position, our power to sort of weigh in and think we are the knowers. Actually, are we really the knowers? And that's what's led me to, you know, it's that curiosity to go into research. And for me in particular, it's really interesting to see how there's a pressing need for us to sort of integrate culturally relevant approaches into global mental health systems. It's really important. For example, in Africa, and indeed many parts of the world, you know, we talk about traditional healers. They have knowledge. They've been doing this for donkey years. And we just want to assume that, you know, nothing, what they're doing, we just want to close our eyes to them. And that's not right. So I would say curiosity in addressing this knowledge gap is what's led me to conducting this research. And I think it's really needed for us to sort of bring many more people on this journey in that sense.
Before we go to Dr. Gwale, what you say is so right, because without cultural competency in care, there's no way care could be successful. But I'm also glad that you're also looking into part of the legal aspect of it, what is right, what is wrong. How can we treat patients in a respectful manner, in a more advanced research work that is much more acceptable while we continue to also integrate into cultural competency of the practitioner. That's so very important. I'm so glad for that. So Dr. Ogunwole, can you go ahead and tell what sparks your interest?
I mean, for me as a person, when I was in med school, my mom is a trained nurse. When I was in med school, she told me, I think you would like two things, orthopedic surgery and psychiatry. Well, whatever she was thinking about, I do not know. But somehow, I had the option of actually going to study neurosurgery because I wanted to show my classmates that I was one of the brightest guys around. But in my mind, I realized that that wasn't the way God wanted me to reason. He wanted me to think of value addition to human life, not just demonstrating that I've got a good brain between my ears. So I then realized I would not live the rest of my life proving to my classmates I was one of the brightest guys around. I was going to do something that would impact human life. What did I see with mental disorder? I realized that mental disorder, while it may be associated with high mortality rate or premature mortality, and it could be related to things like suicide attempts and eventual suicides. The thing with mental disorder was the degree of disability that it tends to bring to human life while the person is not dying off. So I'm saying if the person has got a cancer, particularly a malignant type, in a few years, he will be dead. If he's got diabetes poorly controlled, the worst case scenario is that he will be dead. But you see, if someone has got schizophrenia, in 40 years, the fellow is still alive, but not really alive because he's unable to do anything productive with his life. And I'm thinking, if I could bring one man's mind back to recovery, I would have done for mankind so much more than probably treating a cancer or treating diabetes or dealing with rheumatoid arthritis and all these other conditions. I said, if a man loses his mind, even if he exists in bodily form, he's not quite there. It was Renaud Descartes, that French mathematician, who said, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. So when a man has lost his thinking faculty, where his emotions are unbridled and dysfunctional, as you will find in mood disorders, where his mind is so low, as you will find in depression, that he begins to think of ending a good life. Or how do you explain in a person who has succeeded extremely, ending his life the day after an award? How do you explain that? You know, I think during the course of our talk, we'll come to some cultural explanation. But the truth of the matter here is that mental health required that we did something about it. And I thought I could do something in my own little way. There were two main conditions that drew me: schizophrenia and tardive dyskinesia. So I talked briefly about the two. Schizophrenia was the one that drew me first because If you read the medical books, they will tell you that schizophrenia is a severe mental illness affecting roughly 1% of the population and runs inevitably a chronic disabling cause. I mean, that's the way to summarize it. So yeah. When it is inevitably disabling, it means when someone has schizophrenia at 19, if the fellow lives to be 55, 60, the disabling effects of schizophrenia might remain with that person, and that person may underperform and be underproductive. So I thought I needed to do something. If I saved only one, if I helped only one person to recover, I would have done much for mankind, in my view. Now, the unfortunate thing is that the medication that we used to treat schizophrenia, the older medications, they tended to cause an abnormal involuntary movement disorder called tardive dyskinesia.
Yeah.
Now, this disorder is usually irreversible and is so bad that at times it affects the entire body and the person is almost like twisted into a figure you can't even describe on occasion. And I thought, if only I could find the cure to tardive dyskinesia. So I was a younger man, and I thought, even if I got a Nobel laureate for that, it would not be the Nobel that would be my interest. It would be the fact that I reversed tardive dyskinesia. And this was because one of my lecturers, she was not a professor at the time, she became a professor later, told me she had one patient who developed tardive dyskinesia that was so disabling, and it was a terrible, terrible experience for her. For me, I thought I would be spared that sort of agony in my practice. But I tell you, some years ago, I also had a patient who developed the same tardive dyskinesia. It was so terrible, and eventually the patient passed away in a difficult situation, not in hospital, was at home, but the patient at some point developed tardive dyskinesia. So I think these two conditions largely brought me into psychiatry, prompting me to put in my best. And as Oladeo said, prompting me to develop the knowledge that I would require to be able to treat those who are mentally ill, whether it's schizophrenia or any other condition for that matter. And also to use that knowledge to be able to develop safe treatments. I eventually did not go into the field of neuropharmacology, but I am available to support my colleagues with whatever research, with whatever knowledge I have to help them develop safer medication that will be helpful to people such that they can recover without side effects that are equally disabling. So this was what brought me into psychiatry in the mainstream. But in the journey that I took, I then realized that law and policy play a significant role in the kind of services we plan, in the kind of services we deploy, in the kind of outcomes that we measure and obtain, even in the services that we plan and deploy. So all of that together, I would say, had contributed to my interest in psychiatry and to my journey so far.
That is so powerful what you just said. And I really respect both of you for your humility, because it's not about title. Dr. Bifani, you talk about title because I have that certain knowledge, you know, so my knowledge is more superior than anybody else, which is very common of our practice in Nigeria. And Dr. Gunwale, you too have that passion and compassion, because in order for you to be a caregiver, you have to have the compassion.
Yes.
You have to be able to understand and feel for the patient, because that's also part of healing. And I really appreciate that from both of you. And before we go into, you already talk about the rewarding part, because I don't even need to, you know, you kind of like mention it through our conversation of what you've been saying. So as I indicated during the introduction, I came across your research, your publication on PubMed. The report I like there has been a serious human rights abuses in mental health care in Nigeria. And the facilities where the treatment that were taking place were called torture homes, because of the abuse people suffer. And according to the report, many of the centers are now run by religious leaders, traditional healers. Some of them mix both culture and faith-based treatment. So what would you say conducting this research, and why do you think this research is actually needed, if you want to put it in a general form?
Yeah. Dr. Bifare, were you going to say something first?
Very quickly, because Dr. Ogunwale, you practice and you continue to practice in Nigeria. I've never practiced nursing in Nigeria. But I think what was fascinating to me is, again, going back to my response before in terms of this idea of who has this knowledge. Mm-hmm. These people you call indigenous mental folks, I would argue they've got something to offer. Of course, what we have on paper is that, you know, this abuse and violation of human rights is happening in that space. And that is true. And that is bad. And that is not to be condoned. But having said that, it's really important for us to sort of look at the context in terms of, you know, when you look at the ritual, the herbal treatment, spiritual counseling, community-based support, these are indigenous practices and they would serve, because I don't think they are doing that at the moment, as a critical resource when it comes to a system that truly wants to incorporate cultural sensitive interventions. Mm-hmm. Because people have different beliefs. People would have different understanding. We think of Nigeria, for example, with more than 360 ethnic groups. I mean, I can think very quickly of the work of Don Jong in Jos. People are saying, you know, that is my belief. And we can't stand here and say that is not what we need in psychiatry. We need to sort of find a way to incorporate that into our treatment plan in whatever shape or form. So theoretically, that is my thinking. That was what actually inspired me to work with Dr. Ogunwale on this piece of work. I'm sure Dr. Ogunwale would be able to give us more in terms of context and the figures when it comes to abuse and human rights and violations in Nigeria.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bifare. To be honest, I think why I did the research and worked with Dr. Bifare and Dr. Fadikwe, the other author, was because there was a time in Nigeria, I think sometime in 2019, when there was media attention around faith and traditional healers who were running quasi mental health units in which they had principally young men and women that were kept there in chains or manacled or in shackles, and they were regarded as patients under their care. The police authorities invaded these facilities and, as it were, rescued, that's the word, they rescued these inmates or inpatients or whatever you would call them, and they branded those facilities as torture homes. By way of data, they rescued 11 people from a facility in Zaria, Kaduna in 2019, approximately 300 from Rigasa, still in Kaduna, approximately 360 from Daura in Katsina in one facility. And apart from 360, there had been 200 escapees. So in one facility, you were talking of close to 560 people. I don't want to go into the problems of overcrowding, scabies, tuberculosis, etc., that would have been going on in that sort of place. And again, in Rigasa Kaduna, in the same 2019, another 147 from another facility. From Gao Dota Inquara, they rescued another 108. Yola Adamawa's 15, same year. And in Ibadan, in one place, 259. So this was a rash of so-called traditional stroke faith treatment centers from which people were rescued. And then I realized when I was invited to give a talk that we were interrogating the problem slightly wrongly. So we thought we were rescuing these people from torture homes. It then became clear they were not kidnapped by those people, but rather they were taken there by relatives.
Yeah.
So in a sense, there was a segment of society that was patronizing the services that these persons were providing. So instead of branding them just torture homes, mm-hmm. it was important to interrogate what exactly they were trying to represent mm-hmm. and whether that was entirely evil or it was a representation of dysfunctionalities
yeah.
in our own system as a nation. So that was the way I explored my presentation. And I said, why would people patronize faith and traditional healers? Then we realized that there must have been cultural undertones that were regarding the causation, the symptoms, the treatment, and the outcome of mental disorders. There were cultural narratives along these four things. The causation, what causes mental illness? What are the symptoms of mental illness or the cause of mental illness? And then what are the treatments for mental disorder and what are the likely outcomes? Now, as long as there are cultural narratives and there are cultural explanations for them, maybe that is why people are patronizing the culturally adaptive or culturally syntonic environments that government has now chosen to brand torture homes. Yes, I think torture was going on there. I think cruel treatment was going on there. I think degrading inhuman treatment was going on there in some cases, but that was not the entire narrative. So I had to interrogate it as a scientist. And that brought us to the point of, could there be some other factors apart from just culture? Then it became clear to us that people will patronize those settings if the orthodox effective mental health treatment is not readily available, accessible, or affordable. So that became a narrative instead on the parlous state of mental health service delivery in Nigeria. And let me lay the figures before you. In Nigeria, inpatient beds across the nation are just about 4 per 100,000 of population.
Wow.
Funding for health, mental health care is less than 5% of the general health fund. Now, when you put that side by side with what you expect, you need about 15% of the general health fund to go to mental health care to get what you need. And research in Nigeria said, if we are going to get the services we need about 10% of the general health fund. Now, added to that, over 60%, about 66%, live below poverty line.
Yes.
And about 50% live in rural areas. Now, you don't have these psychiatric hospitals that provide 80% of the beds in rural areas. You've got them in the urban areas. So a person has to travel 150 kilometers to access basic care. And when he gets there, he's going to pay out of his pocket in 70% of cases. So you have the poorest living in places that are far removed from care and having to travel to go and pay for service you do not have money to pay for. So why will they not go to the Babalawo or to the prophet somewhere or the Islamic cleric who is about 2 minutes walk from their homes, even if he has to put 560 people in one building? You know, so it was based on all of those that we then decided to interpret the narrative beyond a question of torture or beyond a question of culture or beyond a question of absence of policy to a combination of all of those. And that was why we came up with that research that, then looked at, is there indigenous mental health treatment? How does it work? What should be our attitude as orthodox mental health care practitioners to the indigenous mental health treatment? If torture or degrading treatments occur there, what should be the attitude of government? And finally, is government completely innocent in the scenario within which we have found ourselves, and what must government do to remedy the situation? That's the entire context of the research work.
Thank you so much for that component of what you just gave now. Because the society make the government.
Absolutely.
And the government have so much small amount of budget towards people who are suffering from mental illness. We have to also look at what are the general beliefs in Nigeria as the causes of mental illness? Because when you are in a society whereby the education regarding mental health or mental illness okay, is the education is limited. The knowledge of it is limited. When we talk about people suffering from, apart from schizophrenia or maybe bipolar disorder, people suffering from depression, we consider that to be because somebody is poor, because of your social economic status. That's why that person may be sad or sad. You know, in terms of, you know, you are the expert in this field.
Yes, yes.
There's differences between sadness
and depression. Yes, indeed.
You know, so we think when we just make their life a little bit better, maybe that depression will go away. Also looking at the consequence when all this treatment is not being given. That's why we have so many people in the society. When I was growing up in Nigeria, 60s, 70s, who are alcoholic. We never considered that, you know, that's how they are actually treating whatever it is that they're going through. Even in the music that is being musicians in Nigeria, they say, jiamuti kafe paro nire, meaning let's drink alcohol so that we could use it
to drown our sorrows,
cure our sadness. So can you actually expand more on that in terms of the general belief of the society in Nigeria of what mental health is and what causes mental health?
All right. I know that Dr. Bifane would want to weigh in on this at some point, but briefly, I think that there are many factors that as a society, we would consider to be related to mental health conditions. Mm-hmm. Principally, however, is the cultural preference for a spiritual causation. Mm-hmm. So within African cultures, particularly sticking to Nigeria now, there is a preferred narrative, which is the spiritual narrative. So along the traditional African religion lines, people will talk about demonic possession, in which they will say an unclean spirit or Eshu, which is one of the deities, which is the servant of the deities, is working in the life of that person. Hence the need to intervene using spiritual objects, like whipping them with a spiritual thing or giving them spiritual concoctions. In the same vein, the Islamic cleric is likely to think that somebody who is hearing voices, who is beginning to act irrationally, is likely to be inhabited by jinns. So they will say that, like the Hausas, we say, Al Janu. And when you want to ask someone in the Hausa tongue whether he's hearing voices, you will say, is he hearing the discussion of the spirits? So to ask a person about hallucinations, you must craft it in a socially relatable manner. You must now define those voices as proceeding for what he can understand. So they would call it Magana. And that was what the Hausa man told me. If I just said voices, he was probably going to say no. But if I frame it as the discussion of spirit, is likely to understand. And then the Christian religion would say that if a man is speaking to himself, tearing his own clothes, it looks like the madman of the gatherings in Mark chapter 5 or so. Mm-hmm. So it must be that he's got demons inhabiting him. Therefore, it will be regarded as a spiritual attack, which will require exorcism, deliverance, and casting out the demons. This may include chaining the demonized person, giving him holy water, and flogging him under certain Christian traditions. Now, that is not proper in my view, because the Lord Jesus never flogged anyone. So how they came to the flogging must be because they have now learned about certain syncretic practices, as you suggested before. So there's now a margin of cultural practices with the Christian faith. And so you've got some church traditions that practice the syncretic. So in terms of classifying churches, you then go to syncretic churches, Pentecostal churches, Orthodox churches, evangelical churches, and you will find that their disposition to mental disorders tends to be different, maybe marginally so, but different. So for those who are so spiritually driven, they will talk about demonic possession. For those who are more cognitively driven and science driven, they will talk about changes in brain chemicals and how the emotions can be affected by social factors, and they will intervene differently. So that is the way things are framed in the country in which I practiced, Nigeria. And in my practice, we saw that, and research has also shown that. in a book we published quite recently, we also explored that there are cultural narratives across the world. It's not just in Africa. It's not just in Nigeria. And so in psychiatry, we define what you call culture-bound syndromes. So there are syndromes that tend to occur uniquely in certain cultures. But as clinicians, we find that although we may say they are culture-bound, but the symptom profiles that describe those conditions tend to be represented across cultures.
Thank you so much for that. Thank you, because, you know, I've spoken to people, we talk about hearing spirit. He's talking to the ancestor. How do you know he's the hearing spirit? The explanation that you just gave, that as psychiatrists to understand that, okay, to actually rephrase it, are you really hearing the spirit or are you hearing from the devil or from Satan?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So in terms of actually presenting it that way, so that we understand, I think you need to write a book on this, which I think would be very useful for so many people all over the world, especially we Africans in the diaspora, in understanding how do you culturally implement this kind of language into treatment so that you could be successful in treating this person who is a patient in front of you. Because like you said, I'm coming back to you, like we said, somebody's suffering from schizophrenia, who be saying things, you know, talking to themselves. And in the way we look at things, might, oh, you know, he's just hearing voices. He's hearing what kind of voices is this person actually hearing? Thank you so much for a brief explanation that I think that should be able to be a whole book. Go ahead, Dr. Obifare.
Yes, I think it's profound, the angle Dr. Ogunwale went into. Because for me, looking at it, I would stay focusing on the social aspect. When you talk about limited resources for massive people, a lot of people, and naturally as human beings, what is going to happen is the survival of the fittest. And that's when what tends to then follow up from that is oppression. The ones that are able to sort of get limited resources will then potentially oppress the ones that don't have. And that itself as a way for stigma to be very pervasive. I say that in the context that think of people that have lived and grown up and they've been exposed to adverse childhood experiences. Now, we have a system where just keep it quiet, don't say much. And you move on to a system where, because you've got to, they use the word, and it's not what I'm really comfortable using, you've got to hustle, you've got to be busy. There's something about a culture of busyness where people are no longer in touch with themselves. It's very much this idea of capitalism, where people nowadays, it's a case of, let's go for the next thing, let's go for the next thing. And eventually, what tends to happen is people lose sight of themselves. And when you tend to start to have a sense of, this is the ideal, this is the way I should be operating at my age, my colleagues are doing this, but in reality, this is where you are. And then you start to have the struggle with your identity. But then you look around you, your church, you look around you, your place of work, who do I talk to? And that itself has implications for the mind. That has implications for, you know, how people can thrive in life. And that is a lot that I see in the global context as well, because people have, stigma is very pervasive in nature. It's very, very pervasive in nature. And it's really important that we are building a system that is sort of empathetic towards what people are going through. And in essence, the evidence in front of us when we talk about mental health, very subjective. But it's really important that as much as the patient's voice is heard, of course, we need to also have clinical expertise fit into that. And more importantly, we've got to bring in proven evidence for us to be able to put those things together to provide a service that would speak to that person. And that is the point here, that for us to do all of these things, we need more research, more evidence around culturally sensitive care, because now I would argue that this word at the moment is a buzzword where people just, you know, let's make sure we're culturally sensitive and bring people on board to talk about stuff. We need to go beyond that. And that's the point I wanted to add to what Dr. Ogunwale, you said.
I think you too, you need to write a book, because you just said something so profound now regarding busyness and occupy all the time, which I see taking place among African immigrants here in the diaspora.
Pressure is real.
Yeah, even when there's no need for it, but I just need to be busy. I just need to continue to work. I just need to get myself occupied all the time. as I finish one thing, I'm going to go into another one. Because if I slow down, that means I'm going to go deep into thinking about to a place where I don't want to be emotionally and mentally. And I think a lot of our people are struggling with that. And you also mentioned talking about stigma and how that have an impact. Where's the secrecy? We have to keep things on a wrap because in our community, a lot of things we don't talk about because of shame, because we tend to project, you know, perfection outside. And to actually talk about problems is something that we don't want to talk about. Because when we think about problems, it's as if you're going through or some people are sending you some form of bad luck into your life.
So it's your destiny.
Or it's your destiny, or God is not answering your prayer. Why am I going, or I'm going to be a gossip column for everybody within the community? So we are afraid to actually talk about issue. And thank God, you know, when you are in another country, when you live in another country, it's for you to open up your mind. Apart from, I have a degree in this and that and everything, and visualize what is going on in different communities. How are they handling things? Why are certain group of people or certain race able to talk openly about issues? And from talking openly about issues, they're able to find solution. Question, you know, bring up different research topics to talk about it. And that brings me to the stigma and the impact. How does stigma surrounding mental illness influence the way patients are being treated within the traditional framework as well as religious as well?
So I'll let Dr. Bifari start because he began this discourse on stigma. Mm-hmm. And I think I should let him start with that. You go back to it. Yeah.
Yes.
So Oladeyo, please.
Thank you. I think within the African community at large, and again, I'm speaking from my experience with working with Nigerians in particular, as I mentioned before, stigma is pervasive in nature. And when you think of mental health conditions, they are often misunderstood and with conditions often attributed to, you know, supernatural causes, which Dr. Nwale went into before. And for me, this cultural stigma tends to then lead to social isolation. So when you see that person not coming to church, the way they used to come to church. But instead of actually checking on that person to say, you know, we didn't see you in church, what's happening? People don't do that. Well, people might be doing that, but, you know, it might be a case of, there's a Yoruba word that came to mind, and this was a real story. And it was said by an elderly person in my church when I was growing up, I was a teenager at the point in time, who said, "Bon share we see okan." That was a comment at the time. And you start to look, eventually, they're not coming to church because there's no money in their pockets to contribute. And somebody might see them that, you know, they're not contributing to the, when there's offering going around in church. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, instead of actually getting in there and talking about things that normalize the conversation to say, it's okay not to have, mm-hmm. it comes across judgmental. Even if the intention of the person talking to that person wasn't malicious. But there's something about our culture, largely speaking, that can be very direct, and not many people can take that all the time. Mm-hmm. So you can see how this thing is quite well weaved into our systems, and we've got to be very conscious. So this idea of busyness, oftentimes we don't mean it. But when you do certain things, people will react to those things differently. Mm-hmm. And it's not always a case of you defending yourself. Sometimes you actually instigated the conversation. I'm the one receiving it. So mm-hmm. you should listen to my feedback mm-hmm. as opposed to you standing on, that's what I meant. Because that's how we can support ourselves. Because you don't know what the next person mm-hmm. is going through. And oftentimes, when you don't actually then in the social space, when that is not well catered, addressed, then that leads to late treatment seeking. Yeah. And oftentimes, when it's too late, you can't afford to go to the hospital. Where do you go to? Somebody who can pray for you somewhere. And that's where the society system itself perpetuates, put a lot of pressure on people. And that itself can lead into mental health conditions. And of course, interactions between people that can also sort of reinforce stigma. And lastly, for me, it's this idea that victims often fear being disbelieved. And to me, that's really, really powerful. It's this thing about mental health that people that live with mental health conditions, oftentimes, I hear patients tell me, I feel like I'm gaslighting myself.
Hmm.
Nothing as terrible as you not having the confidence to stand on your two feet and say, you know, I'm hearing voices. Because when you tell somebody next to you, either they don't believe you or you're ostracized. It's all that, or this or the other. And we need interventions that stays in between. There's always a place for everyone. And to me, that's how I would solve, they solve talking about stigma when it comes to mental health conditions, and of course, the impact on people, particularly with particular focus on the social dynamics as well.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Bifare. And where he stopped is he talked about stigma, and it affects the individual to the extent that even the patient, in some cases, now the patient would not wish to express the distress they're having. Therefore, we have found from research that there are two types of stigma. So there is what you call the public stigma, in which it is external to yourself. Other people stigmatize you. And then there's another stream of research, which we've done in Nigeria for some years, called internalized stigma, which Dr. Bifare referred to as gaslighting yourself. So you are not just even thinking they don't believe you. You are coming to a point where you can't even afford to believe yourself. You know, I cannot be hearing voices. How crazy must I be, permit my language, for me to hear voices? So that quickly sends you into some level of denial, and that will put paid to treatment or seeking treatment. Not only that, you might seek treatment, and then you internalize the stigma of, they say that I am not right in the head. So you are no longer thinking of mental illness as a health condition. You are thinking of it as a social construct of who you are. So you are saying, they think I'm not right in the head. I believe now that I am not right in the head. Now, that is the internalizing of that stigma. And research has shown that we've done in Nigeria that internalized stigma reduces your quality of life. So at the end of the day, if somebody has internalized stigma, it will affect his quality of life. Internalized stigma may affect the way a person will respond to treatment. Internalized stigma may affect a person from even seeking treatment and utilizing all the treatment opportunities that exist. So we've looked at research looking at internalized stigma and quality of life, internalized stigma and medication adherence. And everything points to the fact that when there is stigma, it affects the way you go through treatment. Research has shown that in different designs. So it's important that we realize that stigma is not just about people talking about someone who has got mental illness as having mental illness. It's also about the way the people who have mental illness feel and think about themselves. And just to wrap it up, stigma is driven by three things. Underlining stigma are three things. And this was the work of Corrigan and Watson in 2002. They said, if you are going to have public stigma in particular, the first thing is stereotype. So the society stereotypes mental illness and says that those who have mental illness are dangerous. Those who have mental illness cannot marry. Those who have mental illness will perhaps eat their children or something bizarre. So all of us in society unconsciously internalize those narratives. And that is what you call a stereotype. The next stage is called prejudice. The transfer of the stereotype into your feelings. So all of a sudden, when you see someone who has mental illness, you will feel that they are dangerous. You will feel that they are never do wells. You will feel that they cannot complete their university education, because the stereotype is that once a person has schizophrenia, he cannot achieve anything in life. A movie like Beautiful Mind tells us the opposite, that even with schizophrenia, someone can win a Nobel. Yeah. So what are we talking about? So that changes the stereotype. But for as long as the stereotype remains unchanged, it will inform prejudice. Now, prejudice is the feeling state. Stereotype is the knowledge state. And finally, we come to the behavior state, which is called discrimination. So why you find people discriminating against those who have mental illness? It did not happen in one fell swoop. It happened from stereotype to prejudice to discrimination. Mm-hmm. Now, when persons experience either these negative stereotypes or the prejudices or the discrimination, it can affect treatment seeking. In fact, some patients will tell you that the reason I don't want to come to the hospital is that I have to tell the taxi driver I'm stopping in front of Arrow. So they would prefer not to even come. There are people who would say, if I come to the hospital, there is a likelihood I will meet some of the people that I know. Mm-hmm. So they won't come to the hospital because of that. And you can see how stigma affects the accessing of care or even the utilization of care. So it's very important for us to understand this. And maybe one point I could add is that the nature of our society in African settings, and particularly in Nigeria, the nature is a communitarian one. Now, a communitarian society is one in which we all do everything together as a community. And you see that African saying, Ubuntu, I am because we are.
Yeah.
So I exist in the community of humans. Now, when that happens, it has its downside and it has its pros. Now, the downside is that you want to measure up, like Dr. Bifani said, you want to meet the expectation of society. Now, look at the West as a contrast. In the West, it is a very individualistic libertarian, yeah, isolationist tendency, where it does not matter how you dress as long as you like it. It does not matter whether you have the kind of job that Mama Sule's son has, mm-hmm, as long as you enjoy your job. Mm-hmm. But in the communitarian system, if I am a doctor, my son has got to be a doctor. Because how do I explain when we go to the family meeting? My own son now is a dancer. How can he be a dancer? And so in the process of sending him to medical school by force, the fellow might find the academic work extremely stressful and it may actually break down mentally. Now, am I suggesting that people should not bear stress? I'm saying that sometimes we come to stress largely because of societal dysfunctions and the way we have allowed our communitarian ethos to get in the way of well-being. We must strike that balance and we must ensure that society is not something toxic, but something that is an ally for our well-being and progress.
Dr. Ogunwale, I think, you know, you have to do, you and I have to do another topic on just what you just said now. And Dr. Bifani too could be a witness and come back. Because when we're talking about this stigma, we have a lot of issue now with a lot, especially Nigerians, and the pressure many of our children feel from the parents, where they want to define what their children has to major in.
Yeah, yeah.
And you talk about the community, we focus more on the community acceptance,
yes,
you know,
yes,
more than
yes,
an individualistic life.
Well-being, yes.
If my child got admission into medical school, I want to go to church or mosque to announce that my child just got into medical school. Or let's assume in the West, there's top Ivy League school. My child just got into Yale. This one got into Harvard. Any other children who went to local colleges or private liberal arts college, they are not being what being mentioned to celebrate. Or those who want to actually do something completely different, whether they want to learn trade, they are not worth mentioning. And that has a lot of impact among Nigerians, I would say, that I am aware of in our community, because it brings a lot of pressure. It creates so much challenges between relationship between parents and the children. And it contributes to so much mental health breakdown.
If I could just quickly, I mean, comment is responding to Dr. Gumali's point. I just want to quickly sort of segue to, in the UK, for example, and I like you, Dr. Gumali, mentioning that collectivism and individualism, this idea,
yes,
of, you know, stereotype, prejudice, and of course, the consequences in terms of discrimination. Now, what we have as well within in the West, of course. So I'm trying to just say that this is a human issue as opposed to a particular community, but they manifest in different ways.
Yes, indeed.
Within the West as well, where we have this individualistic approach, what you find is that patients as well, oftentimes, are considered sometimes to be this risky object, where we have quite a lot of governance structure that if we're not careful, we are not empowering those patients because we're trying to, you know, safeguard them. So one way or the other, the point is, one way or the other, our behavior would always have consequences. But what's really important is having a mechanism to help people understand those behaviors. I don't see a problem with somebody going to the mosque who announced that their kid got to Yale. Now, how I take that feedback is now up to me. So we've got to sort of find the balance in the sense of people cannot respond the same way. And that's where it goes back to the first question you asked. What drives me is that knowledge gap. And that's where interventions need to come to support people wherever they find themselves. Because right here as well, we can see how issues around abuse has been politicized in the UK, for example. And that contributes significantly to people being quiet when issues like abuse happen to them. And that itself has impact. So I think I just wanted to sort of raise that to say, you know, it's a human thing, but it's really important that mental health is given adequate attention. This idea that mental health is just something that is arty-farty over there has an implication for countries' economy, of course. In the UK, for example, people are talking about people need to return back to work. Of course, something is going on somewhere, and we've got to sort of go back to a system that values human beings as opposed to seeing people as numbers. I just want them to do. And I think that's the point I want to sort of add to your point in that sense.
Yeah, thank you so much. So I want to ask you, Dr. Pifani, how can traditional beliefs that stigmatize mental health be challenged without undermining cultural heritage?
I think a very, very quick answer to that goes back to you having a system that validates these beliefs. Validates in the sense that if you're trying to consult or you're trying to work with a patient who has a particular, when they wake up in the morning, they've got to do a particular ritual. Now, if that is part of the personal recovery, let them be. Mm-hmm. As opposed to you trying to sort of give that a particular name. If they are going to do that at the same time, take the medications you give to them and it's part of their personal recovery. And I use that word consciously, that I'm not saying clinical recovery. I'm saying the personal recovery, clinical recovery, have your medication and all of that stuff. It's really important that we have a system. And Dr. Gunwale might be able to challenge me on this in terms of, you know, in 2021, I think it's January, this National Mental Health Act 2021 in Nigeria. I think it's a good opportunity. It's opening doors for more structured dialogue. If people are able to sort of own into that legislation, that's my opinion, because it's a legislation that is very well welcomed, in my opinion. And it's one that we think we need to start to have a roundtable conversations. Let people bring in those belief systems. Let them not hide it away. We are best knowing what they know as opposed to pretending to that, you know, we are the orthodox practitioners. They are over there. This idea of othering people or othering systems needs to stop. And to me, that is how we can sort of influence sort of mental health delivery or mental health support, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you so much for that. Dr. Ogunwale, you have anything to chime in on that?
I mean, I think that the most important thing has been said by Dr. Bifari. I only wanted to sort of bring us back to one point that you had mentioned earlier on, which was cultural competence. There is some degree of research in cultural competence as we speak today. Mm-hmm. People have looked into what constitutes cultural competence beyond just bandying the word around or the phrase around. What does it mean? From the research I have reviewed, because we had to look at culture and forensic practice in a book we did a few years back, and we realize that cultural competence is three things. Number one, there must be scientific mindedness. You must seem to appreciate that there is something hypothetically positive about what people have believed for years. Mm-hmm. Maybe something hypothetically positive for them as human beings. So the next thing is your willingness to test hypotheses relating to what people believe about themselves or about what they say is going on with them. As a matter of fact, there's a whole world of research called transcultural psychiatry, in which people then talk about mental health symptoms as idioms of distress. Can you see that? They're using English language to describe that when somebody says, I have pain in my head, it could be an idiomatic expression for a sensation that is linked to depression. You must be scientifically minded enough to explore what this hypothesis symbolizes. The next point is dynamic sizing. You must be able to size up the patient before you in a dynamic manner. What do we mean by that? You must be able to separate that patient from his community as well as separate his community from him. So you must be able to tell us when you think that that person represents his community and when that person, in spite of his community, is unique as a person. Mm-hmm. So that dynamic sizing helps you not to say, oh, young black men are so dangerous that they have to be admitted involuntarily. Now, a clinician who is not dynamically sizing will see a young black man and quickly, if he is probably not black, may just say, from my experience, they are like this. Now, that they are like this is a failure of dynamic sizing, because he has his society or community rather, but is distinct in some respects from that community. Your capacity to know when that person is inclusive and when that person has to be treated exclusively is your dynamic sizing. And the final one is culture-specific expertise. So in Abeokuta, I will not ask my patient, are you hearing the voices of the spirits? But in Katsina, the only way I can ask him about the voices is he hearing the voices of the spirit? So in the West, I will ask somebody, if I want to be informal about depression, are you feeling blue? If I ask a Yoruba man, she or Kareda be Aro, he will say, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? You know, but I must be able to ask him, is your stomach bad? Now, if I went to the white man and I said, is your stomach bad? He will say, stomach is not bad. Mm-hmm. And he's depressed, but I can't say stomach, because when you say to the Yoruba man, now the word inu there can be translated as stomach or translated as mind. But if I call it okan, he will think it is heart. So the Yoruba way of asking about depression is stomach or is abdomen, is it feeling bad? The white man, I've got to ask him, how is he in his spirits? So if I say, how are you in your spirits? Are you low in your spirits? He will say yes or no. If I tell it to the man in the bada, are you low in your spirits? He will say, I reject it. Jesus, you follow my point? So if you don't understand cultural-specific expertise, you are going to fail in your cultural competence. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that is important. It is when you understand all of this that we then come to the point that Dr. Bifani was making. How do you then validate the human being's belief system and yet be able to educate him to something that could be more positive for his recovery? Mm-hmm. The World Health Organization, as I speak to you, has recognized the role of spirituality in well-being and health. Mm. The Royal College of Psychiatrists in the United Kingdom has recognized a spirituality interest group. There is research looking at the role of spirituality and how you actually take a spirituality history from a patient. From what I know, there is now a whole segment of healthcare that is spiritual care. And in many hospitals all over the world today, you have chaplains. Some of these chaplains belong to one religion. Some of them are non-religious, the chaplaincy services. The point we are making is even in our scientific world and mindedness, we recognize that we must validate the belief of the patient so that we become his ally, not his opponent or his foe. It is crucial to getting that person to recover. So I believe that's how we will validate, and then to educate will be easy. And as Dr. Bifani said, we must first admit that the knowledge we have of another human being's phenomenological experience is at best partial, that the deficiency of knowledge that we have is made up by the knowledge that that person has, and it is as valid as our own.
Yes, thank you. I know Dr. B. Farren said he has to leave, you know, because he has to get to somewhere. So I just want to ask him the last question before you leave, Dr. B. Farren. I want to ask you, how does stigma surrounding mental illness and lack of availability of care contribute to addiction or increase the number of people addicted to drugs, alcohol, or any form of other addiction?
That's a very, very broad question to solve, but I'll make a start on that one. There's something about people's upbringing. There's something about people growing up and having the right structures in place, the role models, the right structure in place, the right funding for the family to be able to raise a child without abusing them, without spanking them, without a system that can allow dialogue to happen, irrespective of age and gender. I think that's the foundation to us supporting people when it comes to, you know, growing up. Because what I see behind this is a lot of work I'm currently reviewing at the moment. It's when you start to struggle with your identity. Why am I here? It's painful. A lot of my patients that I've nursed over the years, it's always that question of existence. To us, it's a mental health condition. To them, it's their existence. What is the point of being here and not being here? What is the purpose of living? And that, when you start to question your existence, it's a painful one, such a way that people want to numb that pain. People don't want to be distressed. It's not an argument to say use of drugs is right. It is bad practice, but it's important for us to go back to the basics. How society, how we failed people, because we are now in a system where we just want to keep doing, want to keep grabbing. But at the heart of this, what are we not paying adequate attention to? Mm-hmm. Ourselves, our families, people close to us. How are we actually having dialogue in a sensitive manner, particularly given the context we have now? And to me, that is the underpinning issue that we currently have, because people are getting poorer. People are living longer. Young kids like the Gen Z. Nowadays, when Dr. Gunwale, myself, perhaps growing up, it's a case of you've got to be a medical doctor. Now, nowadays, how much is a medical doctor earning compared to a tech bro somewhere? So now you can see that the landscape has changed drastically. Mm-hmm. And it's a case of identity. And unless we're able to normalize conversations and support people, I see a lot at the moment, particularly women groups mentoring other women. I look around me sometimes and you're thinking, where are the men mentoring other men? And at the moment, I don't see many of them. They would exist, but it's really important, because this idea of, you know, drug abuse, it is out of people are responding to their pain using drugs, but that is not the best approach. And that's my contribution to that in a very short space of time, of course.
Thank you.
But it's a pleasure to be here. Dr. Ogunwale, I'm sorry, I just had to run.
Thank you so much. So, okay, Dr. Ogunwale, would you want to chime on that as well?
Yes, I think Dr. Bifarin started off on one angle to that entire story. So when we look at addiction, we see the causation of addiction or factors that underpin addiction as in three broad categories. So you've got the biological factors, You've got the psychological factors and you've got the social factors. So he started with the social factor of people being under a lot of social stress and then trying to numb their pain, social practices that make people feel abused, and that abuse leads to the trauma, and the trauma leads to pain, emotional pain that they wish to numb. There is also the biological, in which we have found from research that the sons of alcoholics tend to be alcoholics themselves. So we are not saying that we have found the gene for alcoholism, but we know that those who have alcoholism running in the family may become alcoholics themselves. In particular, the research is strong regarding alcoholism. Now, by the time we come to other factors that are biological, we look at the presence of some other mental disorders. Research has shown that those who have schizophrenia, when they hear voices, there is a need sometimes for them to use certain substances like cigarettes, which contain nicotine, to drown out the voices. So you might find that those who hear voices tend to smoke a lot more, because when they take nicotine, the nicotine stimulates the nicotinic receptors, which then help them to disregard extraneous stimuli like the voices they are hearing. So in a sense, there is a biological explanation for that addiction to cigarettes that you have found. Of course, there are those who become addicted to opioid drugs like maybe tramadol and things like that, merely because they suffered from a physical injury and then they were placed on that medication. And because that medication stimulated certain receptors and they experienced a set of mood elevation, they enjoyed it and went back to use it. Some people, because they don't want to feel low when the drug is going down in their body, they go back and use it. And from then on, they may become addicted. So there are biological explanations. But then we come to the psychological explanations. There are certain personality types that are prone maybe to anxiety or to some other form of emotions that they want to deal with, and they use drugs to cope. So if you have someone who's got an avoidant personality disorder, or somebody who's got a dependent personality disorder, or somebody who has an obsessive compulsive personality, what you call an anarchistic personality, he wants to cope with the stress of having to think the same things all the time, then he will go and use substances to calm him down. And before you know it, he becomes addicted to it. So you can see that there are psychological factors that may be underpinning that. So I just wanted to say that it is not a simple problem with simple causes. It is a complex problem with complex causation as well.
Thank you so much.
I know you have to go to the legal and advocacy effort in Nigeria. What are the protections that exist now for individuals with mental illness in Nigeria?
I think the protection is a lot, but whether we implement the protections is another matter. So if we start from the Constitution, there are constitutional provisions in the 1999 Constitution as amended that will help to protect a person's rights, including the right to freedom, the right to liberty, which may be infringed upon when you send people off to these faith healing and traditional centers that are not licensed by government. They have constitutional rights that the police can give effect to, and they can be rescued from such places. Then you've got the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You've got the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, Section 3, Section 6 of that. I would speak to the right to life and liberty. I think Section 5 speaks to the right to freedom from cruel and degrading treatment, which people go through in those places. And then specifically in Nigeria, there's the Anti-Torture Act. And specific sections of that act indicate how people should be protected. And when people get tortured, those who do so and those who collaborate with them will be faced with the wrath of the law. So if you look at all those, you've got protections under them. But importantly, we now have the National Mental Health Act 2021, which was signed into law in 2022, December. And by God's grace, I've had the privilege of working with the Ministry of Health as a technical resource person in drafting the roadmap to the implementation of the law. I will say that as of today, 2025, at least 3 years after signing that bill into law, that law is still not implemented. So there is a law But that law is just still on the pages of a book of the Gazette. It is still not in full force because the organs of government that must be established for the law to be functional have not yet been established. So if you would take that from me, there are protections, but the degree of implementation of these protections is still very poor. And in particular, the National Mental Health Act 2021 is the parent legislation that will secure the rights of those who are mentally ill in Nigeria. And unless that law is fully implemented, there will still be many cases of the deprivation of human rights of those who are mentally ill, I'm afraid.
Yeah. If I don't ask you this question, I will slap myself later on. And it has to do with gender.
Yes, please.
How does gender influence the experience of abuse in indigenous mental health treatment? For example, me growing up in Nigeria, women who may be going through mental disorder or psychosis being labeled as witches and some of them being stoned to death. I don't know how.
Yes.
So how does gender influence the abuse of mental health?
I think it's a very complex question or situation because principally what we're looking at is the structure of society. And that's what plays out in some of these treatment centers as well. So you have a society that is patriarchal. And once it is patriarchal, the woman is seen as a second-class citizen in many respects. They don't say that in government circles because we now know better with regard to gender equality and things of that nature. But underpinning the societal structure, the man is the head and the woman is now regarded as something less than the head. Now, that is not the right position, but unfortunately, that is the real position. That is the reality on the ground. So you can imagine when you then take that sort of person into a treatment center where their main tool is the use of force. And the people who will use this force many times are either men or women who have recruited men to exercise force on their behalf. So I suppose that both men and women who come into those settings as patients will undergo some degree of abuse. But I suppose that the risk might be more for the women, and I'm just speculating, might be more for the women merely because the society treats the woman sometimes as second fiddle to the man. In addition to that, in societies where sometimes people almost in their conduct condone the sexual abuse of the female by victim blaming. Sometimes they condone it because society does not even allow the victim to talk about it because the victim will fear being disbelieved or being ridiculed. Then a lot of the patients who are in such places might be undergoing some form of sexual abuse, not just physical abuse. And we also know that homosexual activity could occur in such places, as has been reported sometimes in the media. So it's a lot of abuse going on, and it is not just about one gender, but I agree with you because of the skew in the current structure, in the gender balance within Nigeria. It's likely that the women might be at the shorter end of the stick, I suppose.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I could keep you here for more hours because there's so much knowledge that you're able to share. And I know many people who are listening to this will really appreciate the knowledge that you share today. I really appreciate both of you. I know you have to go, and I can't just thank you enough because there's so much knowledge that you incorporate into what we talk about today regarding the culture, regarding communication, because many therapists who may listen to this podcast, we understand, as well as psychiatrists, how do I speak to an African patient who come into my office? There's a different explanation of how they understand different terms. You know, I have to think about that. And I really appreciate all those aspects that you gave, because like I said, I could keep you here all day. And I really appreciate that. Maybe we have to make another plan to have another form of dialogue again. Thank you
for having us and for inviting us. Thank you.
Pansa continue to normalize conversation about the importance of community engagement, about African immigrant experiences in America and in the diaspora, as we publicly continue to discuss difficult issues within our community, we're shredding away stigma that is associated with uncomfortable dialogue.
I want to thank Dr. Adeboyega Ogunwole and Dr. Oladayo Bifaren. I want to thank both of you for joining me today and sharing your insight into these important and complex topics, your perspective on this role of indigenous care, the challenges surrounding mental health stigma, the human rights implication of mental health patients has truly enriched this conversation. As we have discussed, there's a critical need to balance respect for the cultural tradition with the promotion of passionate and evidence-based care. This dialogue is just one step towards raising awareness and fostering understanding, and your contribution have been instrumental. Your knowledge, your experience have shed light on issues that are often overlooked but are crucial to addressing mental health care in African communities and beyond. To our listener, thank you for tuning in. We hope that this episode has sparked reflection and dialogue in your own circle. If you'd like to learn more about my guest and explore the resources we have discussed, please check the show notes for more information, which I'm going to be posting their research work, the link to their research work. So let's continue this important conversation. As always, stay informed, stay compassionate, and take care of your mental health. Until next time, take care of yourself. And by the way, if anybody is experiencing mental health challenges within the United States, please dial 988. Dial 988. That is the Mental Health Emergency Services. Thank you. Take care of yourself.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Ponza Ponza Live Podcast. We hope to have you back with us in the next episode as we continue to explore the nuances of the African immigrant experience. If you'd like to connect with us, you can email us at talk@ponsaponsa.org. That is talk@ponsaponsa.org. And follow us on Instagram at ponsa.ponsaforum. Until next time, remember to spread kindness and love. Thank you and take care of yourselves.